The following is a production of DifferentBrains.com.
Hello, and welcome to Spectrumly Speaking. I'm Becca Laurie. I'm your fellow autistic and also a certified autism specialist. And I'm joined here by
Dr. Lauren Gerber. I'm a clinical psychologist in private practice in Florida, who also has some books, including Autism and You. And today we have a wonderful guest with us, Dr. Gil Lichtstein. He is a diplomat with the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. He's in private practice with adult, child, and adolescent in the area of psychiatry. He's the medical director of South Florida TMS here in Boca Raton in Miami, Florida, and an affiliate and clinical assistant professor of child biomedical sciences at the Charles E. Schmidt College of Medicine at Florida Atlantic University. Welcome, Dr. Gil.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. We're very excited to bring you in today. And I know you just recently presented to your colleagues, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I was on a continuing medical education cruise, and I was one of the lecturers, and one of the topics I lectured on was more of giving it like an overview and a current update on autism spectrum disorders, and gave a little bit of a background as to what autism is, the etiology, pathophysiology, how do you arrive at a diagnosis, and then really focused on the pharmacological treatment of autism and what are some of the symptoms and behaviors that are targets for psychopharmacological interventions.
So in that lecture, was that to just medical doctors in your field or to others in addition?
In the audience were medical doctors, MDs. There were some pharmacists, some nurses. So I think that even the non-MDs were able to at least, I know the pharmacists were able to at least have an understanding of when I got to talk about the pharmacology, I was hoping that, that the talking about some of the background stuff, like the etiology and pathophysiology and stuff like that, that gave him a better understanding of what autism is.
In terms of the key elements of autism, it has a very early onset, often before 30 months of age. And show some delays and some difficulties with things like social interaction and communication. What are some of the medications and pharmacological agents that in your practice you've seen helpful with symptoms of autism?
Symptoms that are often targets for psychopharmacological interventions include like irritability, aggression, self-injurious behaviors, and two atypical antipsychotics, risperidone and aripiprazole, are FDA approved and have some good literature to substantiate their use. Other symptoms clusters that are targets for psychopharmacological interventions are hyperactivity, although the literature is not as robust or positive, but nonetheless, there's some data with the use of methylphenidate, a stimulant commonly used to treat ADHD, and atomoxetine, or Strattera, a non-stimulant used to treat ADHD. And then the other domain is repetitive behaviors, behavior rigidity, stereotypies, kind of like this OCD type aspects to autism. And again, the literature for that isn't really robust, but there's at least some favorable data in the use of fluoxetine or Prozac and citalopram or Celexa, which are serotonin reuptake inhibitors used to treat depression, anxiety, and OCD.
I'm going to stick my voice in here and play a little devil's advocate at the moment. As someone on the spectrum, the use of medications is a topic that I feel can go either way. Because I hear you talking, but I want to make sure we're clear with the people that are listening. There's really no medication or pharmacological agent that really works on autism itself. What we're doing usually is treating the symptoms of some other co-occurring disorder, co-occurring behavior. So we're not giving medication that works on autism, which is something what people are always looking for, the next new fad of the thing that's going to help autism. So I just want to be sure that we make sure and clarify that to everybody.
You are correct about that. These medications really don't target or really address like the core, you know, symptoms of autism, the, you know, lack of emotional or the deficits in social reciprocity, problems with social communication. That is correct. These don't target or treat those directly.
Okay.
And there really aren't any proven medications or pharmacological treatment for the core, you know, symptom or the core elements of autism spectrum disorders.
Mm-hmm. And do you happen to find, which has been my personal experience, that individuals on the autism spectrum tend to need less medication than most people in terms of the dosages that are given?
Well, I mean, I would say generally that with the medications I listed as ones with some proven data in treating those three different targeted areas, that in general doses used were less than what's used in the general population to target those same symptoms, correct?
Yeah. Is that something I think we're also finding in as advocates on the spectrum when we talk about bigger issues like how to deal with your psychopharmacologist, your psychiatrist, your other medical professionals, the conversations between the two groups, it gets kind of learning to advocate in that setting is a little bit complicated for everybody. You know, it's sort of the, do you say, no, I'm not going to do that to the person in the white coat? So I think it's really important that we talk about how sensitive it seems the metabolism of folks on the spectrum is. I know if I take what is the quote unquote normal adult dose of anything, it will floor me. And so I just want people to understand there are times when you're in a medical situation where it's okay to say, can you give me the smallest, or I am sensitive to medications, and to advocate with your medical professional for the medications you're looking to take. Is that something that you encourage when you're dealing with individuals on the spectrum?
Yes. I mean, I make it very clear that individuals with autism, you know, with autism spectrum disorder are more sensitive, you know, to medications, whether it has to do with their metabolism or per se in terms of how quickly or how slowly the liver metabolizes medication, which genetic factors play a role in, versus is it because of developing effects on their brain to begin with, and then the kind of downstream effects that has on the rest of development could be. But I make them aware that the use of medications is helpful in targeting certain symptoms, but that, you know, by no means do I tend to try to get aggressive with doses, and that I take a very kind of start low, go slow, mm-hmm. and very careful approach.
So I love that. I love that little go slow idea, because I would love, you know, the reason I want to play this role is to give people kind of the idea that you can say to your medical professional, I don't want to do it this way. I need to, for me, my body is different. I need this thing. And we know, you can hear from Dr. Gill that we know that autistics don't need as much medication. So it's really important to be clear with your medical professionals about where you stand. And I know that's kind of, for me, the last wasteland of untouched advocacy right now for me. We need, you know, I really believe would love for every medical professional to be as trained as you and Dr. Lauren and some of the psychologists that I know are. But unfortunately, they're not. So it's really great to hear what you should be hearing from your medical professional from somebody. And I if you're ready, and Lauren, are you ready? I'd like to talk TMS.
Oh, well, I agree. I'm very interested in hearing more about TMS, and also, Dr. Gill, the start low and go slowly idea of medication can be also applied to other therapeutic modalities and complementary mm-hmm. treatments for autism. So I'd love to hear about TMS, and maybe we could start with, a lot of our audience may not have heard of it, so maybe just a short definition of what TMS stands for and what the equipment is like and possibly where people can learn more about that. I know you have a website for your South Florida TMS, so maybe we could start there.
Well, TMS stands for transcranial. Well, it's an acronym for transcranial magnetic stimulation. And essentially, without getting too technical, what it is the application of the use of repetitive magnetic pulses applied to a specific area of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's a circuit in the kind of front part of the brain that has been shown to be involved in the regulation and mediation of mood. So it's the application of targeted repetitive magnetic pulses, similar to the strength of an MRI machine, of a standard MRI machine, and that the pulses that are delivered can either stimulate or turn on or inhibit or turn off the underlying circuitry. And a lot of it depends on how fast or slow the pulses are delivered, whether delivered at high frequency or low frequency. But in another way of summarizing it, TMS uses a computerized electromechanical medical device to produce and deliver non-invasive magnetic stimulation using brief duration, rapidly alternating or pulsed magnetic fields to induce electrical currents directed at spatially discrete regions of the cerebral cortex. That's kind of like a definition of what TMS is. So it's using a magnetic pulse to cause underlying brain tissue to be stimulated.
Right. And I just want to give you a chance to explain this, because the reaction I get from people when I talk about it ever, everyone goes right to the, oh my God, it's shock therapy.
It is not at all. Unlike shock therapy, which delivers either direct or alternating currents of electricity to the entire brain, this utilizes focused magnetic pulses to a discrete region of the cortex. And so it stimulates or inhibits just that particular area. So it's not does not have a systemic effect on the brain or a direct systemic effect on the brain like shock therapy. So it's very much different. Even though, if you want to say the purpose of TMS is kind of like ECT, they're using electricity to stimulate brain tissue. Here, it's using magnetic pulses to stimulate brain tissue. This is more directed, non-invasive, as opposed to shock therapy, which is more invasive and more systemic.
Mm-hmm. What is the course of treatment, the time frame, and what kinds of diagnoses benefit from TMS?
Well, TMS is only FDA approved to treat major depression in individuals who have failed or have not responded to their current course of antidepressant medications in the course of their current depressive episode in individuals 18 and above. However, there is a lot of proven literature of TMS and its effectiveness in treating post-traumatic stress disorder, which I believe will probably get FDA approval in the immediate future. And there's also some good data in the treatment of other anxiety disorders, bipolar disorder, OCD. There's some, albeit very scant, literature in the treatment of ADHD and autism, as well as addiction, as well as non-psychiatric conditions such as chronic pain, tinnitus, or recurrent ear ringing. So it looks like it's going to have wide use of applications besides just treating depression.
And my experience with TMS personally is actually through a friend. I am friends with John Elder Robison, and he's probably within our community the loudest proponents for his experience with TMS. I don't know how much of his stuff you've read in regard to it, but he had some really interesting experiences with it. For him, they were targeting his emotional brain, and they were working directly with that area. And he had, actually, it was, I guess, in terms of TMS successful, in terms of turning on his emotions, but it was for a limited duration. So I'm curious in terms of how often, if it is a treatment that works for you that you want to do, and you do it once for the duration of the treatment, how often do you have to repeat?
In treating major depression, the general course of treatment entails it's a daily treatment for 36 sessions. So we're talking about, 6 to 8 week period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a one-time thing. It's not a, something that you do when needed or when you feel down or when you feel sad or anxious. This is a daily treatment for 30, for at least 36 treatments or more, depending on the individual.
Mm-hmm.
I also, like in treating, non-FDA indicated conditions such as post-traumatic stress disorder or other anxiety disorders, I will also recommend a course of 36 treatments. Now, for non-psychiatric disorders like tinnitus or ear ringing, that may be different. I've had a couple cases where I've treated patients for tinnitus, and again, this is not FDA approved. There are no there isn't any accepted protocol, but I found in the literature a study that was done in the VA in Portland, Oregon. So I called the lead investigator and talked with him, and he did a course of 10 treatments every 5 days, for 2 weeks, over 2 week period of time to treat tinnitus. So when it comes to some of these other conditions, how many treatments one will need is still kind of up in the air, because we don't have any, real set protocols like to treat mm-hmm. chronic pain or migraines or tinnitus or addiction. But when it comes to treating depression, we do know that at least 36 treatments will be necessary on a daily basis. And that even with like anxiety disorders, probably it's going to be in that kind of number as well.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Gill, thank you for sharing that information. Where might someone find more information on TMS?
Well, they could go to my website, southfloridatms.com, or they can also look up Neuronetics, Neuronetics. That's one of the three FDA, or is it one of the four FDA approved or cleared TMS machines available in the United States, for use of TMS. And neuronetics.com can provide information as well about at least their machine, but also give some ideas about the basics and the principles and what TMS is.
Well, fantastic, Dr. Gill. I really look forward to looking more into it, and maybe we'll have you back if we do a show with a couple of guests. That would be lovely.
Thank you very much. Being a guest of Spectrumly Speaking, where can people find out about you, not just TMS?
They can go to my website, www.docgill.com. That's docgil.com. And that also, there's a link there also to my TMS website as well. So you can go to that website too, follow it, and then can link on to my, South Florida TMS website as well.
That sounds great. Is there anything else before you go that you would like to share with us about autism or about your work in this field?
I mean, generally, that what I've found, at least with my experience with parents who brought their kids in for treatment, that if they, bring them in early enough, that, a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder isn't this doom and gloom diagnosis, that it doesn't mean that the child's going to be incapacitated or non-functional or incapable of succeeding at all. And that if, you have any concerns, in the course of the first 2 to 3 years, you're noticing something that's not right, get them checked, get them evaluated. And that if there is a high suspicion of possibility of autism, get the interventions you need, and things can still be okay. And it doesn't mean that your child is in for a difficult life necessarily. If you get the help early enough, it can kind of change the course and the outcome.
So early support, early treatment, early diagnosis, all of that is key.
And only
to
help.
Yes.
All right, Lauren, let's talk about some news. How about that?
Sounds great.
Okay. I have a really cool article that was written by a woman who does a blog, and I just ran across it. Her blog is called Michelle Sutton Writes. She talked about self-care and what that looks like in people on the spectrum. And are we kind of taking what we call in autistic terms a special interest and turning it into this faux pas thing and that people should not be spending their time on when it's really an act of self-care? And maybe we should be encouraging it. So I thought it was really interesting because she kind of paralleled what it looked like for her to be doing self-care as someone not on the spectrum. And so for her, she used the example of gardening, of always wanting, you know, when she's having a really rough day, she just, the time that she goes out into her garden is her time to recharge, taking pictures of her garden, you know, being out there for hours and not wanting to be disturbed by anybody else while she's out there. And as a neurotypical, nobody questions it. But if her child was to go do a similar thing and be that invested in whatever activity it is, like for many kids, it's Minecraft. For many of us adults, perhaps it's space or science related, anything like that. And people go on a rough day. They've been maybe sensory overwhelmed, whatever, and they seek their special interest as a place of solace, as a place of recharge. So rather than discouraging a special interest, it's teaching someone more how can you use your special interest to take care of yourself. So I thought that was a really fascinating take on kind of revamping the negative stigma that attaches itself to special interests.
I think that's very interesting because everybody should have a special interest or may have a special interest. In my practice, patients will come in and be looking for their purpose or looking for something that's part of their life that they can use on a day when they're down or they're anxious or things are, as you said, overwhelming. Mm-hmm. So I think taking that special interest and elevating it to self-care in the same way that we do about eating right and exercising and doing healthy activities for yourself, I think is a very important way to conceptualize that.
Yeah, I mean, I find it for me to definitely be a source of self-care. I'm an introvert by nature. So while much of my job requires me to be an extrovert, it actually drains a lot of my personal energy. So when I'm looking to recharge at the end of the day, I always seek out my special interests. I've been hyperverbal for as long as I know and hyperlexic for even longer than that, which means I find solace in words in general. So I'm usually reading somewhere just to kind of resettle myself in that calm state. And it takes a while, but it's a vehicle for me to kind of emotionally regulate and to physically regulate. I mean, that's sort of, I think, what most people do when they're doing their special interest, if they're not spending money somewhere to support their special interest. That, I think, is usually the biggest struggle people have is the financials of having a special interest. It's a great tool.
It's a great tool, and not all special interests have to be expensive. And sometimes there's a way to modify what you are doing to make it something more cost contained.
Right. And I think it's just such a, I always think that when you meet somebody where they're at, or you find that common ground where you both are at, it's sort of this really nice way to begin a friendship, to start a relationship, whatever it is. So I think, you know, the way that we kind of sneak social in to our special interests is a really good way to share your special interest with somebody else. You kind of enter into a relationship with them via your special interest.
And you alluded to your special interest. What is that?
Well, I'm a reader all the time, but cats are definitely one of my special interests, animals in general. So usually when I'm not working, I'm helping out to volunteer at rescue organizations. I kind of do what I can to do the social media for a couple of groups, mostly because for me, it feels like, okay, I've done what I can within the autism community for the day, and here's another community I love. So let me give my energy there. Because I think the love that animals give back is unconditional, and I love it. So that's where I choose to kind of spend my self-care, is doing those things, either with my pets or with other pets that perhaps need homes. So I have a lot of really good friends that are not autistic but are part of that group of my friends that I've met socially through my special interest.
Well, thanks for sharing that with everyone. As you're mentioning animals, I'm looking at my sleeping therapy dog, Giovanni, who's on the sofa snoring while we're making this.
Always on duty, being very, very good. I know Walter was eating his bone, and he's now gone upstairs to go outside because he is having an antsy puppy day today. It's been raining, and he can't run. So he's now antsy and inside. All right, Lauren, what kind of news do you have for us today?
Well, I saw an interesting article on BET, and it's titled, Here's How Ice Cube is Taking Action and Raising Money for Autism. Nice. And he shares that this is a personal cause for him, and he is partnering and sending his proceeds to Autism Speaks. And his quote is, my goal through this campaign is to not only help raise awareness, but also to support this great organization's efforts in promoting solutions for the needs of individuals with autism and their families. And what he's done is he has featured an exclusive t-shirt design and also rewritten the music for a song of his that's well known called It Was a Good Day. And It Was a Good Day by itself couldn't be released with its original lyrics, but he designed it so that it could be used for autism awareness. So it's interesting to me that musicians and different individuals are bringing in their special interests, their skills, their talents for such a wonderful area of needed research and awareness.
Yeah, it is. It's really fun at this time of year to kind of look around and see where the loud voices are coming from and, you know, where we're getting our supports from as a community. It's really just a lovely time of year in that respect. Well, I think that about wraps it up for today. Please check out Different Brains on their Twitter at @diffbrains and look for them on Facebook. I can be found at beccalaurie.com or on Facebook or LinkedIn.
And I can be found at drlaurengerber.com. Please be sure to rate and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. And don't hesitate to send us questions for our future shows. And we look forward to keeping this conversation going here at Spectrumly Speaking.
Spectrumly Speaking is a production of Different Brains. For more information, visit us at differentbrains.com.